The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The foundation offers charitable gift annuities, charitable remainder trusts, and pooled income funds. Talk to your financial advisor about how these income-generating and tax-saving tools can build resources for community organizations. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org. 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Ahead this evening, as migratory birds start making their annual stop along New Jersey's Delaware Bay, we'll meet an author who followed their 19,000-mile-long journey. First, while the mayor's race is garnering most of the attention in Philadelphia, voters will also be picking members of city council this year. The race for at-large seats on the Democratic side of the ledger doesn't occur in November. Rather, it takes place 1 week from today. WHYY's Tom McDonald explains that incumbents don't have the slam-dunk odds of a normal year.
There are seven at-large positions on city council. Two are guaranteed for the minority party, which in Philadelphia are the Republicans. That means when the final primary vote tally is in for five at-large Democrats, they're virtually guaranteed their seats in November, unless by some amazing groundswell of voting, three Republicans beat the lowest vote tally Democrat. Currently, there are four incumbents in at-large positions, since Jim Kenney resigned to run for mayor. In the past, incumbency gave you an almost guaranteed shot at re-election, but this year, that's not the case. Councilman Bill Greenlee says he and others running for re-election will do fine, but the departure of Kenney has brought strong challengers into the race, knowing there's one open slot.
If Councilman Kenney had stayed Councilman Kenney, I think there probably would be at least a few less candidates. I think some would have still run, but I think there would have been a few less candidates. That's absolutely true. And we knew that as soon as Jim decided to seek other office, we knew that that was going to bring more people in the race, but that's the way it goes.
Councilwoman Blondell Reynolds-Brown says being an incumbent means you have something your challengers don't, a record to run on.
There is an advantage to being an incumbent. Presuming, and if you have a strong legislative track record, and I do. A legislative record really still matters. Success is cumulative, and you can't acquire that over two or three days. For now, we're talking about 14 years worth of good work, some of which is going to be in place long after I'm gone.
Reynolds Brown says she's unapologetic about being a voice for women, children, and families.
Being a former educator and knowing that that still ranks number one, two, and three on anyone's agenda, being a voice and a champion for funding of public education is something that I believe distinguishes me as well, because I've come up with some good ideas about funding education, and quite frankly, I've come up with some bad ideas.
Councilman Wilson Good Jr. drew the lowest ballot position. Not good when you have 16 candidates on the Democratic ballot. Good believes that he has been a champion for working people and helping the economy.
I've did the Working Families Forum. I've done other forums, and in most of those forums, I've got a chance to exchange ideas with other candidates on issues of education, the economy. Unlike other candidates, I have the opportunity to present my track record, having introduced 155 bills, 140 of which have become law.
Ed Nielsen is the newest member of City Council, winning a special election to fill the unexpired term of Bill Green, who resigned to join the School Reform Commission. Nielsen admits a bad ballot position and his neophyte status have him concerned about re-election.
I am nervous. You always want to make certain that you touch all bases and touch all neighborhoods. The going citywide is much different than I'm used to being in a little house race, because there's only 65,000 residents in a house race. I've been at every corner of the city at least twice, and I'm working my way around and doing the best I can to make certain the voters get to know me.
There's also the possibility of ballot fatigue. Voters have to wade through a top half of a ballot full of judicial candidates before finding council-at-large candidates almost at the bottom of the ballot. Councilman Greenlee says people could just vote in a few races and forget about the at-large contest.
It's a concern, certainly, and when I go out to meetings, I talk about that, and I talk about that there's nothing wrong with some voters occasionally starting at the bottom and working their way up. So, you know, we know that, that's a problem, but it's something that is kind of out of our control.
Councilwoman Janie Blackwell says she hopes to keep the current group together.
The question is, given this crazy, crowded ballot, what will happen? So nobody's secure, especially at large people aren't secure. But I think we have a good council, and I'd like to see everybody return.
tomorrow, we turn to the dozen Democratic challengers seeking to win an at-large seat. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
In the 7 years since Marcellus Shale gas companies began operating in Pennsylvania's state forests, none of the nearly 1,700 affected acres has been fully restored to the way it was before drilling began. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports that scientists and state foresters are trying to plan for the future and help gas companies figure out the best ways to clean up after themselves.
We are in the Tyodotten State Forest above Waterville, Pennsylvania. We are building a mock well pad to test different soil and ecological restoration techniques.
Kelly Sitch is a botanist with the State Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. He spends a lot of time in the woods, keeping an eye on how gas development is changing the landscape. This mock well pad is his latest research project.
And the overall goal of this is to figure out kind of how to put the forest back together, right?
Right. We want to go from a well pad that at the time is essentially non-forest to reclaimed site where we're kind of restoring ecosystem function.
This one-acre clearing is a scaled-down version of what would likely be left after a gas company has brought in a big drilling rig, finished up the fracking, and put the wells into production. So what's it look like? Well, the trees are gone, the soil is compacted, and there are lots of rocks lying around. DCNR forester Ben Gamble is digging through them as he plants saplings.
So we're in the process of loosening up some soil and planting some bare root seedlings in the area surrounding this pad. So there are a lot of stones up here. Some of the soils are mixed.
Which is very much what we would see at many of the well pads following some sort of interim reclamation.
The research team here is trying out four different techniques. On one end of the spectrum, they left the compacted soil and rocks and added some topsoil. On the other end, they dug furrows nearly 2 feet down to loosen things up and added topsoil. Penn State University senior Bill Wall is among a group of students helping out.
At Penn State, you learn a lot about the Chesapeake Bay and fracking. Those are the two things that's pushed on our degree, but I've never been to a fracking pad, and I've never seen, like, you just look at it from Google Images. It's pretty eye-opening, I guess, that the fragmentation that occurs with the infrastructure that goes into developing natural gas.
Of the nearly 200 well pads in state forests, only about 5% have been even partially reclaimed, meaning some equipment has been removed and perhaps grasses, shrubs, or trees have been planted. So far, none of the Marcellus sites in state forests have been fully restored to the way they were before the gas companies arrived. Sitch says that's largely because they're still in use.
The fact that we haven't seen a lot of reclamation or restoration yet isn't a concern because we want this site to be a number of years ahead of a lot of our work, just so we can do all that work better.
Patrick Drohan teaches ecosystem science at Penn State's College of Agricultural Science. He's leading the research with a grant from DCNR. He hopes to find best practices companies can use now in the interim before they pack up and leave for good.
What we're trying to do here is show how if you go a couple extra steps by alleviating that compaction, and by diversifying your plantings, you can greatly improve that status quo. And so that can be used now.
Gas development is just the latest challenge for DCNR's foresters, says Sitch. They're charged with balancing conservation efforts and making use of natural resources, whether that's timber, oil, or gas.
In my mind, this is just a new part of our mission to restore Pennsylvania forests. It's a little bit more complex. It's a little bit different than what we learned in ecology or forestry school, but it follows along those same lines.
The research team will be watching this patch of land for a long time to see which techniques work the best. It could be decades or even generations until the state's forests are fully restored from Marcellus development. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania, Lycoming County.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, the Pennsylvania State House today passed a Republican pen proposal cutting billions of dollars from local school property taxes, replacing that revenue with higher sales and income taxes. The measure still requires a vote in the Senate and then Governor Tom Wolf's signature. New Jersey's Department of Children and Families has implemented new training courses and protocols to help protect workers from violent attacks. Department Commissioner Allison Blake told the State Senate Budget Committee today that workers can now take courses on self-defense, situational awareness, and violence de-escalation. 83 degrees, mostly clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:16. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Clear skies overnight, low 56 degrees. Sunny again tomorrow, breezy, but cooler. Wednesday's high only 68. Sunshine on Thursday as well, high 72 degrees. Clouding up Friday with a high in the low 70s. The next chance of showers comes Saturday, otherwise cloudy, high near 80. Still ahead, we'll look at America's long history of Islamophobia and free speech that incites violence.
All of us who are concerned about free speech have to stand up and denounce every single threat against free speech, including the speech by people whom we detest.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Arden Theater Company presents Passion by composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim. A tale of love and obsession, Passion won the Tony Award for Best Musical and boasts one of Sondheim's most lush and romantic scores. Set in 19th century Italy, Passion finds a handsome army captain pursued by a mysterious ailing woman. Opens May 21st. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or ardentheater.org. The Arden Theater Company supports WHYY.
A small town in Germany prepared housing to take in refugees from abroad. And then
the buildings set on fire from one day through the night. Everything was destroyed.
I'm Steve Inskeep, one town's small part of a giant refugee crisis. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
Proudly supporting WHYY is Camp Hill Special School, an accredited Waldorf school with day and boarding options dedicated to redefining what is possible for children and youth with special needs. Students not only contribute to their class communities, but the community as a whole, taking part in festivals, starring in plays, caring for animals, participating on student council, and fulfilling meaningful roles in their on-campus homes. Offering an open house on May 16th and a campus tour on May 20th at 9 a.m. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. At full and new moon this month and next, the ancient horseshoe crab emerges from the sea to spawn and lay its eggs. And that's precisely when the migratory red knot bird en route from Argentina to the Arctic will fuel up on those eggs, where the world's largest population is concentrated in the Delaware Bay off the coasts of New Jersey and Delaware. Let's go there with Deborah Kramer, author of The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and an epic journey. Deborah, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Deborah, by the time the red knot arrives in our region, it will have completed more than two-thirds of its epic journey north. What in turn has compelled you to log tens of thousands of miles to follow and study the red knot's annual trek?
Well, the first time I went to Delaware Bay, I was astounded by two things. One, I went down to a beach in the middle of the night, and the tide was high, and the moon was full, and thousands of horseshoe crabs were coming in to spawn. I could see them in an unlimited line of horseshoe crabs in either direction. If I had been an hour earlier or an hour later, I would have missed the whole thing because they would have gone back into the water. And then the next day, I went down to the beach, and there were thousands of birds frantically scurrying across the beach, trying to eat the eggs that had been churned up by the waves. And I was curious, why were these birds in such a hurry? Where were they going that they were running so fast? And where had they come from that they were so hungry? And that's what led me to follow them along this migration that runs the length of two whole continents.
And the horseshoe crab has been around, well, it's one of the world's oldest extant creatures, isn't that right?
Yes, and when I wrote my first book, Great Waters, all the science seemed to say that this animal was 350 million years old. By the time I finished this book, scientists in Canada and in Morocco had found even older fossils, so now the crab is 475 million years old. It survived every single one of Earth's great mass extinctions, including one that wiped out 97% of life in the sea. And every other animal that was living at that time, 475 million years ago, is extinct.
And what many may or may not realize is the extent to which it's inexorably linked with modern medicine.
Yes, it's kind of astonishing that we are so dependent on an animal that is this old. But it has a unique property of its blood being exquisitely sensitive to potentially lethal and dangerous contamination in all of the vaccines that are made, injectable drugs, and implanted medical devices like heart stents and hip replacements. So all of those drugs and devices are free of this particular kind of bacterial contamination because the blue blood of the horseshoe crab is able to detect it.
Was that leading to a dangerous depletion in its population?
The biggest threat to horseshoe crabs is taking them for bait. There's really no need to take horseshoe crabs to catch eel and whelk when there is an alternative bait that could be used. So if we weren't taking horseshoe crabs for bait, the population would be able to rebound.
What are some of the pressures that are compelling the diminished sightings of the red knot?
The biggest one that contributed to the bird's population plummeting by 75% was that the birds couldn't get enough horseshoe crab eggs to eat because we'd been taking so many. The horseshoe crab lays its eggs in the sand, and it lays about 80,000 in a season. The waves sometimes dislodge some of the eggs, and it's those eggs that the birds are eating. To put this in some kind of perspective, in order for the bird to gain the weight that it needs to eat 400,000 eggs in the 10 days that it's in Delaware Bay. So 40,000 knots need 16 billion eggs. And so the density of eggs has to be really, really high.
Does the red knot enjoy protected status?
When I started writing the book, it didn't. But as the book was going to press, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided to list it as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and that went into effect this past January. So when they come north this year, and they're just arriving in Delaware Bay, they have this new status.
Deborah Kramer, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Deborah Kramer is the author of The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Earlier this month, two gunmen were killed by police when they opened fire at an event in Texas where cartoonists gathered to draw images of the Prophet Muhammad, which many Muslims consider to be blasphemy. The event was sponsored by Pamela Geller. She's a conservative blogger whose stated goal is to bring about an end to what she refers to as, quote, the Islamization of America. On this episode of That's History, let's consider free speech that incites with Jonathan Zimmerman. He teaches history at New York University. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Good to be here as always.
Geller says she'll wear a bulletproof vest while hosting more events just like the one in Garland, Texas. She obviously recognizes the potential for violence in response to her efforts to decry what she calls Islamic extremism.
Well, look, I think if you look at Pamela Geller and her organization, what you see are a group of people that are part of a much longer history in America of it's fair to call Islamophobia. I know that Geller denies that and denies that she's prejudiced against Muslims. But I think if you look at a lot of her prior statements, what you see is an idea that Islam is a violent and intolerant religion that's bent on dominating the globe. Just to be absolutely clear, I don't feel that because she expressed this view that she should be the subject of violence, and I deeply support her right to express that view. But I think the view also has a history, and we should be aware of that.
Take us back in time.
So if you look at Poor Richard's Almanac, Ben Franklin, he asks rhetorically, would it be better to follow Muhammad or Satan? And to the founding fathers, Muslims were a kind of negative referent against which they compared their own quest for freedom. So we're a freedom-seeking people, but Muslims are slavish, they're violent, they're intolerant, and also they're bent on dominating the globe, including us. So if you go into the 19th century, you see that during the time of the Ottoman Empire, there was fear of a so-called Muslim pope coming out of the Ottoman Empire who would send legions to the United States.
All these examples long before Al-Qaeda, ISIL.
Well before. And interestingly, in the American West itself, anti-Mormonism often invoked Islam, strangely. So people who didn't like Mormons would say, this is the Islam of America. They likened Mormons to Muslims because they said that Mormons are polygamous, even though, of course, they weren't. They had renounced this at this time. And also because Mormons painted this picture of a heaven of beautiful eternity that some people thought mirrored the vision of eternity in Islam.
Would Geller's specific message, though, have more adherence if it wasn't painted with such a broad brush?
Well, look, if her claim is that there's a strand within Islam of people who are highly intolerant, highly violent, and willing to use any kind of measure to squash certain kinds of speech, he's absolutely correct. There is absolutely a strand of Islam right now in the United States and in the world that is highly intolerant and violent, and Geller's not wrong about that. I think what he's wrong about is saying or implying that that kind of intolerance and that kind of violence inheres in the religion writ large. That's the problem here, and I think that's the distinction that Islamophobes lose sight of.
Though in practical terms, are cartoonists, for example, whether with Charlie Hebdo or here in the United States, going to be less likely to participate in these kinds of open spectacles where there is the potential for violence?
Well, look, that's my fear. And I think that's precisely why all of us who are concerned about free speech have to stand up and denounce every single threat against free speech, including the speech by people whom we detest. You get to speak your mind without threat to your body. That's the fundamental principle of our society, and whenever we see it violated, we have to stand up and protest.
Even if it's Pamela Geller.
Definitely.
Jonathan, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Zimmerman, he teaches history at New York University. Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. We'll continue our review of the Philadelphia City Council at-large race tomorrow evening with a look at the 12 challengers who hope to snatch a seat away from an incumbent. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.